I'm Chris Sims, and this is the Canadian Taxpayers Podcast. We're dedicated to lower taxes, less waste, and more accountable government. In this episode, we have a special interview for you. Our Prairie Director, Todd McKay, speaks with Conservative Party leadership candidate, Peter McKay. McKay is from Nova Scotia and was first elected to Parliament back in 1997 as a Progressive Conservative. He's a former Crown Attorney, and his father, Elmer, was a Cabinet Minister in former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney's government. Peter McKay helped to create the current Conservative Party of Canada with former Prime Minister Stephen Harper, and he served in Harper's cabinet as Minister of Foreign Affairs, Minister of National Defence, Minister of Justice, and Attorney General. He's married to his wife, Nazanin, and they have three children, Kian, Valentia, and Caledon. Todd managed to flag Peter down on the campaign trail. Here's their conversation.
Today we've got Peter McKay joining the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. He's a lawyer. He served in Stephen Harper's cabinet as the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Minister of Defense, Minister of Justice, Minister of just about everything at some point. He's running for the leadership of the Conservative Party now. And I should point out that despite the fact he has a very, very good last name, he's not related to me. I think we should be clear about that. But in any case, Mr. McKay, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd. I'm pleased to be with you. And I see you have an instrument there behind you. So in addition to being good with your tax dollars, you're talented on a guitar.
I own a guitar. I wouldn't say that I'm talented. There's a bit of a distinction there, but I appreciate that. Let me jump into some of the issues. The carbon tax is a huge issue for the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. Certainly, you've been vocal on that issue as well. If you become prime minister, how soon will you get rid of the carbon tax? Is that going to be before or after lunch on your first day?
Yeah, that is right at the top of the list and something that we can do immediately. At the provincial level, as you know, some provinces have moved forward. Others are challenging it. So those who are challenging will know that they have a friend in a Conservative government and a Conservative Prime Minister that will scrap the tax. As you know, it does nothing for the environment. It causes Canadians' day-to-day lives to become more expensive, whether they're dropping their kids off at hockey or soccer or going to get the groceries. And it punishes our manufacturing sector, and it's unfair everywhere, especially in rural Canada, where you can't take transit to work. You don't have the same perhaps options that you might have in a bigger city. So I will scrap it, and I will not replace it with a national pricing and regulatory regime. It's a tax that has to go. It's just a tax, and I would get rid of it, and I mean it.
I'm going to move on to another topic, and this one's a bit of a sad one. The Trudeau government is banning thousands of guns. He's going to spend at least hundreds of millions of dollars to buy back those guns. That's the plan. That announcement came in the wake of the tragic murders in Nova Scotia. Obviously, you're from Nova Scotia. What went through your mind when you heard that announcement?
Well, you know, people were still reeling from the 22 murders, the worst mass shooting in our country's history. The funerals had not even been held, in part because of COVID-19. It was made even worse because people couldn't comfort their neighbors and friends and loved ones the way they would in different times. And so, Todd, to be very frank with you, it was crass. It was shocking that the government would use such an inopportune time to push a political agenda. To do so, to me, was an enormous insult to the families and to Canadians. And let's be clear, this gun buyback will have no impact on public safety. It would not have prevented this shooting. It is cloaked in so much misinformation about military-style assault rifles, because those type of guns have not been available in Canada since the 1970s. And so again, like the carbon tax, I would scrap the order in council. I would get rid of Bill 71. I would put the resources dedicated to this and more towards securing our border from the importation of illegal guns, mostly handguns. I would put the emphasis on police resources being able to address gun crime in our city. gangs, people who use weapons for an illegal purpose, as opposed to giving the public some misinformation that duck hunters, collectors, or sport shooters are the problem. They're not. They are the first people to respect the law, to take significant steps to ensure safety. I've been to gun ranges. I've seen collectors. I've talked to many people who can't understand why the government would target them in such a crass way. And so that's my priority. I would undo the changes that the Liberal government has made, and as we did when we were in government, go after the real criminals, including with mandatory minimum penalties for gun crimes and seizing vehicles if they're being used for trafficking and illegal guns.
We've talked about a couple of policies that you could move quickly on if you become prime minister. There's one now that's going to be a very long-term challenge, and that's the deficit and the debt. Is now going to be in the neighborhood of $1 trillion for the national debt very quickly. What would you do to get the deficit under control, and what kind of ballpark timelines would you be looking at?
Yeah, the timelines are the toughest part of that. But I'll be clear, I signed the Canadian Taxpayer Federation pledge, and I will honor it. I don't intend to raise taxes if I'm the prime minister. Let's go back to basics. The current Liberal government, as you know, racked up north of $100 billion in deficit spending before we got to COVID-19. And now, of course, it has blown through the roof. We're at $343 billion and counting, debt now tipping over $1 trillion. And one thing I know for certain, we're not going to get back to balance anytime soon. It's going to take an enormous amount of efforts on the part of Canadians. But we don't get our economy back on track by raising taxes. In fact, I would suggest and I would advocate and I would take the approach of lowering taxes. Lowering taxes actually increases government revenue. We also need to do something I think that is long overdue, Todd, and that is simplify the tax code. It's been 50 years since there was a comprehensive review of our tax code and our laws. We need to make Canadians more secure in understanding the tax system. And I think, quite frankly, what we can do to ensure that we're more competitive, that we're able to attract more direct foreign investment, is lower taxes, because we are in this global environment now where we're competing. Capital is going to go where there can be a return on investment, where there is a sense of security, a feeling that they are not going to see punitive new taxes. And let me be clear, this idea that we're going to tax equity in people's homes is a disaster. I would never do that, nor a luxury tax. We are seeing from this government now the natural Liberal inclination, which is to squeeze more tax dollars out of every working Canadian that they can. And because of the deficit spending now, the place where we find ourselves has every man, woman, and child owing an enormous amount. And when I heard the Prime Minister talk about, you know, he's doing deficit spending now so Canadians don't have to, this is ludicrous. This is a complete disconnect. It's like saying the budget balances itself. I spent time around the cabinet table with a Prime Minister who happened to be an economist, a federal finance minister who had previous experience at the provincial level in Jim Flaherty, and we addressed a global recession at that time in 08-09. And we didn't raise taxes. We brought about efficiencies in government. We went line by line through every government department twice to make sure that we were bringing about government efficiency. And in spite of having run an enormous deficit, nowhere near the one we're dealing with today, but when we left office, Todd, in 2015, we were back at balanced budget. And so I have that very much in my experience and in the back of my mind as we look down the barrel of this extremely challenging deficit. But the goal has to be to get back to budget. But I also have to add that until we see the real numbers and, you know, the Parliamentary Budget Officer, the Auditor General, they are complaining that they're not getting full transparency from government. Parliament hasn't exactly been functioning the way it should. And so we need to see the real books and the real numbers, I think, before anybody can correctly and accurately respond to that question.
Let's look at that other side of the equation. You touched on it a little bit. There are already people advocating for higher taxes, whether it's a wealth tax, a home equity tax, those kind of things. You're looking at going the other way in lowering taxes. How do you face down the pressure to increase taxes and sketch a little bit what it would look like in your plan to reduce taxes?
Well, I think it's well documented that when taxes are lowered, Canadians do feel more inclined to pay their fair share. We have an issue right now in the country, and it's happened before, with the black market and people saying, listen, you bring me a load of hardwood and I'll drop off a load of shingles. That goes on. That type of black market increases when taxes are tipped over the 50% mark. There's a psychological tipping point, I think, when you're paying more than half of your income or you're working more than half the year to pay the government. And it depends, of course, the punitive impact of that often depends on where you live, Todd. In certain parts of the country, the cost of living exponentially higher. And so for that reason, I say we need to lower taxes. There needs to be clear rules in place. There needs to be an understanding that the government isn't wasting money. And I dare say that when we see the billions of dollars that have been pumped out with very little oversight, it seems indiscriminate to me, the type of spending. It wasn't targeted. It wasn't timely. It didn't have sunset clauses in place. The WEE scandal is worth mentioning here, a $912 million grant program with a big amount to go to the WEE Foundation, who were going to distribute it, money coming directly back to the Trudeau family. This severely undermines public confidence and increases cynicism and makes people feel very resentful about higher taxes. And so there are industries, I believe, that can be helped, that are going to increase their output. They're going to hire more people. They're going to increase their revenue stream. The post-COVID-19 world has to, in my view, it has to grow our economy. And how do we do that? Well, our natural resource sector is the most obvious place to start. We need to build pipelines. We need to be able to ship more goods, commodities around the country and out of the country. Therefore, identifying new markets, places like India is a great place, I believe, for us to start. We should be first in line with a similar comprehensive economic trade agreement that we have with the European Union, of which the UK pre-Brexit were part of. We should be there, ready to sign a free trade agreement with the United Kingdom. And again, that puts us in the line ahead of the United States. We're really just scraping the surface in terms of our trade opportunities in the European Union now. I'd say the same of South Korea. Our government, the conservative government, of which I was a part, signed the most trade agreements than they did in the previous 50 years. So that is an area of growth. Technology. We need to repatriate Canadian technology, bring more Canadians and innovators home. We need to dramatically increase our manufacturing capability. That, I believe, is an area that also has great job growth potential. And our manufacturers are ready to do that. Many of them were very adept in pivoting to make essential goods that were discovered to be lacking because of lengthy supply chains and an over-reliance on the Chinese market. We also need to, and we talked about lowering taxes, we need to make government more efficient in the delivery of its services. We need to increase consumer and business confidence. We need to have those pro-trade policies that will also, I believe, lead to more direct foreign investment. Although certain countries like China, I would suggest we're going to have a moratorium. And all of this is predicated on growing the economy that will allow everyone to benefit, but including government revenues, to pay down deficit, to get back eventually on the path to a balanced budget. It is going to take time. Creating jobs, reducing red tape, erasing some of the regulatory burdens and hurdles that businesses have to get over. That's the path I would follow, not increasing corporate welfare, and certainly not creating an environment where existing Canadian jobs and corporations can't seem to thrive, and we're turning away the opportunity of others investing in Canada.
You mentioned that people get a little bit grumpy when they pay a lot of taxes and then they see some of that money wasted. It's easy to talk about it in terms of big numbers, but I think it's helpful to talk about specific examples at times as well. The federal government right now is poised to spend about $17 million renovating Harrington Lake. Millions has already been spent. That, of course, is the cottage that's available for the Prime Minister's use. We did some checking, and you can get some pretty swanky cottages for an awful lot less than $17 million. We're seeing Oscar Award winners and Stanley Cup champions spending less money for their cottages. What do you think of the idea of selling Harrington Lake?
What does the Prime Minister need a cottage, you know, 20 minutes from his home for anyway? I see no hesitation in, you know, selling that property. I think there's a lot of government properties, quite frankly, Todd, that we could sell, including the CBC building downtown Toronto, including some of the, I know when I was at the Department of National Defense, we had some properties that that were either up for sale or could be sold. The Canada Lands Corporation, to me, has not been the best real estate broker. Unfortunately, I expect during the aftermath of COVID-19, commercial real estate prices may not be what they used to be, but certainly a full examination of the government's inventory of property could reveal some very, very valuable returns on investment and free up property, quite frankly, that could be used much more efficiently and for a better purpose. We have a lot of dormant properties that I suspect Canadians in the private sector would be interested in buying.
All right, I'm going to move on. You mentioned corporate welfare, and obviously there's already pressure. There's always pressure for corporate welfare. We're hearing Bombardier pop up again, whether it's stimulus or corporate welfare or bailouts, whatever the terminology. If a company like Bombardier comes knocking and asking for money and you're in the Prime Minister's office, what's the answer?
Well, it depends on the ask. If there's a case that can be made that the return on investment will be there, if there are contracts in play that are going to result in the company doing well and paying the money back, then we'll consider it. Bombardier, as we all know, doesn't have a good track record for that.
I'm going to take it a step further on the corporate welfare. Obviously, the Atlantic Canada Opportunities Agency, Western Economic Diversification, some of those development agencies, they fire out a lot of cash. What about winding those down and putting those resources into lowering taxes to help everybody?
I actually think, at least my experience as a former minister of the Atlantic Canada Opportunities Agency, is that there is a return on investment. Not on every program, not on every investment, but they've actually been quite good at helping new entrepreneurs, especially those who are coming from a university or community college setting. It encourages entrepreneurship. There's a partnership that's in place, at least in Atlantic Canada, with provincial governments in terms of trying to discover ways in which they can, you know, grow those businesses, attract private sector investment, angel investors, and those from outside. So I wouldn't agree that winding down those agencies would be the first thing I would do. I think we try to squeeze more efficiencies out of it, make sure that we are doing a deep dive into how that program spending is being used. But that's part, again, of what I would describe as deficit reduction action, which is what we did during the recession in 08-09. And so it isn't just the regional development agencies, Todd. It's across government. It's looking for ways in which we can find savings in all the government departments. That's one that we have to look at for sure.
Let's talk about another really big line item in the budget, equalization. Obviously, the issues in Western Canada are significant. Even Western separation is not something that can be ignored anymore. And equalization is a huge part of that conversation. What do you do to fix equalization?
Yeah, I think there's no question we need to update it, especially in a post-COVID-19 world. Alberta is mightily upset. It's part of the Western alienation feeling, which is legitimate, which is justified. I begin every conversation about Alberta and Saskatchewan with a thank you for the roads and the schools and the hospitals and programs that the rest of the country has enjoyed, and the job opportunities. You know, my generation and the one before in Atlantic Canada, many of them left to go to Fort McMurray and to Leduc and to work out west. Clearly, there has been even more division sown in the last 5 years with the Trudeau government. And the division in the Federation right now, the fraying at the edges or the fault lines that are there are of real concern to me. I'm going to work tirelessly to address the issues of national unity. I say parenthetically, we also have to ensure that our party stays unified in order for us to be in a position to do that. But a fair deal for our resource-producing provinces is absolutely what has to happen. We have seen the ebbs and flows in some provinces. Newfoundland got a huge boost out of the Hibernia offshore development, and we're doing very well for a period in time. Alberta, in large part, not because of a drop-off in the oil itself and the resource, but the necessary infrastructure and the interference of government policies. Things like Bill 69 and the anti-pipeline, anti-tanker bills that were put in place. So those things can be changed, adjustments can be made in regards to the equalization, but to really remove the thorn from the paw of the lion in Western Canada, I think we also have to remove some of the anti-productivity and anti-prosperity legislation that the current government has put in place. That will, to me, clear the path for our Western provinces to get back to being productive and producing jobs and producing commodities that will be good for the entire economy of Canada. And I think it'll also lower the pressure and the tension that they're feeling and the disconnect that they feel from Ottawa.
I'm going to take a step in a different direction here. The Canadian Taxpayers Federation has partnered with an Indigenous activist named Charmaine Stick. We've gone to court because her band leaders won't disclose what's going on with the band's money. So we've had to go to court a number of times. And the reason for that is because the Trudeau government is not enforcing the First Nations Financial Transparency Act. What would you do with the First Nations Financial Transparency Act?
Well, you know, it's important to note, Todd, that we put that in place. That was one of the first things that we did after being elected in 2006. So, in short, I would restore it and require accountability and respect for the law. The First Nations Transparency Act, to me, was hugely beneficial to our First Nations. It ensured that money was getting where it was intended, that it wasn't being misdirected by band leaders, that it was being fairly distributed. That was the intention. And it's unfortunate that the Liberal government scrapped that legislation. It boosted accountability and transparency for the betterment of all First Nations on reserve. And I believe we can bring that back. I think that type of accountability helps with reconciliation. And it helps to pursue the new partnerships for big projects like pipelines, for example. First Nations are the fastest growing population in Canada. We want them to be full participants in some of these big projects and opportunities, as was the case with the Wet'suwet'en Band, for example, in British Columbia, which began this incredible period of blockade, which was hugely detrimental to our country. That file was also badly mismanaged by Mr. Trudeau, who was out of the country at that time, pursuing this vanity project of the Security Council seat, which failed miserably. Anyway, I'm getting off topic, but meaningful Indigenous engagement, shared benefits, robust environmental assessments, First Nations transparency fits in with all of that, and it helps us to bring about greater public confidence in government spending and government finance overall, because there is tension there. When we see some of these situations like the one you're describing, where there's a refusal to be accountable for, let's be clear, these are large sums of money, then, you know, we need to get back to basics of transparency and openness.
Another step forward on the transparency openness. I wanted to throw a specific example in front of you. In 2009, Liberal MP Michelle Simpson started posting her own office expenses on her website, right down to the specifics of, you know, $200 to sponsor a family skate night in her riding. Former Liberal leader Michael Ignatieff was very opposed to that and put a lot of pressure on her to take down those expenses. If you're a Conservative Party leader and one of the members of your caucus does just what Ms. Simpson did and posts those kind of expenses online, how do you react?
I said it's brilliant. I'd say absolutely. I think your constituents want to see more of that. And so I always respect proactive disclosures. I think, the rigors of being in cabinet, you're expected to do that. Just like you can't accept gifts of $41,000 for African trips. What Mr. Morneau has become wound around the axle on now. He's taking a lot of heat for it. So that type of proactive disclosure, I think, is fine. It's great. It should be encouraged. And we talked earlier about our government bringing in the Federal Accountability Act. It may be time to, up the requirement for members of parliament as well. Expenses, costs associated with offices included. I think that there's great interest on the part of the public and certainly on the part of the Taxpayers Federation to see how members of parliament and members of cabinet are spending taxpayers' money.
I've already taken you over time, so I want to ask one more question that's kind of a fun one, I hope. I was doing some research, and in 2009, you were in the media because you broke your arm playing rugby on Parliament Hill. You're well known as a big rugby player, so I want to put this question to you. What is more dangerous, a rugby scrum or a media scrum?
Oh, a media scrum for sure. Well, the reputational harm and the self-inflicted harm that can come from a media scrum can last a lifetime. Broken arms heal, broken noses heal. I've been in a number of both, and I would go with the media scrum being far more dangerous.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. Really appreciate that. Any last things that you wanted to share?
Well, thanks for the work that you do. I really appreciate the work of the Taxpayers Federation. As I said, received this in the mail today, and I encourage people to support the good work that you do. I think it really complements what I call good conservative values and principles of being fiscally responsible with taxpayers' money. And we can all do with more fiscal responsibility, especially in a post-COVID-19 world.
Well, again, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us, and stay safe on the campaign trail.
Thanks, Todd. Hope to see you again soon.
Thanks for listening to the Taxpayers Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show and please share it with your friends. You can find interview information in our show notes and links to all of our past podcast episodes on our website, taxpayer.com.